turn to the first chapter of Job. First chapter of the book of Job. We should just read the opening verses again. Verses 1 to 5. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was perfect and upright, and one that feared God and eschewed evil. And there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters, whose substance also was 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels. And you'll notice the figures, don't want you, as we pass on. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, the 7 and the 3. And his substance also was 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels, the 7 and the 3 again. And 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she asses, and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the men of the east. And his sons went and feasted in their houses, every one his day, and sent and called for their 3 sisters to eat and to drink with them. And it was so, when the days of their feasting were gone about, that Job sent and sanctified them, and rose up early in the morning, and offered burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. We shan't get any further than that this evening. We've just read the introduction to the book, and I remind you that we have concluded that this book was written somewhere around the time of Abraham, either contemporary with Abraham or maybe in advance of Abraham's day, that Abraham came from the same part of the country in the Middle East that Job lived in, that the language of the country was very similar to the Hebrew, were several dialects and variations, but we understand that the people who lived in the valley of the Euphrates had a language which was very, very akin to Hebrew, and no doubt Job spoke in one of these languages. The book must have been originally compiled, we think, by Elihu, one of the characters, a young man. It must have been compiled, maybe the body of it at the time, but the book was never completed for a generation afterwards, because we do read in the concluding chapter how Job continued to live upon the earth a great length of time, and that he had another family equal in numbers to the one that he had lost. So we may reckon that the book was finally completed at any rate some 60 years after the events which it described take place. We suppose, and it's a very feasible theory, that Abraham brought the book with him when he was commanded by God to leave Ur of the Chaldees and to come into the land of Canaan. And that in due course it was preserved in his family and came down to Joseph, the Prime Minister of Egypt, and finally to Moses, who lived some 400 years after Abraham. And that when Moses was in the land of Midian, a fugitive from the wrath of Pharaoh, whom he had offended by slaying the Egyptian, during Moses' 40 years in the desert of Midian, the wilderness of Midian, that he was not idle. He was not only keeping sheep of Jethro, his father-in-law, but he was also very busy. We believe that he carried with him this precious manuscript and that he edited it, put it into its present form. It has been preserved ever since as amongst the oracles of God. It must have been before Moses received the law on Sinai. Else there would surely have been some token in the book of Job of the law of God. Moses would have found some way of introducing the divine law. So we conclude that if he was the compiler of it, the editor of it, the preserver of it, it must have been while he was in Midian. It could not have been after the deliverance from Egypt. For there is nothing in this book which suggests the broader revelation of God which came in the second half of the life of Moses. As such, the book is a very interesting survival, apart from its intrinsic worth and merit, a very interesting survival of the old patriarchal religion. You must remember that religion was only established as a public observance after the flood, only established after the children of Israel had been delivered from Egypt. Religion before then was of a patriarchal type. The head of the family was the priest of the family. Job offered sacrifices for his family. That was his function, that was his right. It was conceded and acknowledged. The worship was of a family nature. There weren't churches, there weren't public assemblies. There was no written Bible. They had only the historical records which had been handed down to them from the days of Adam. But there was no Bible as such. The Bible first began to be compiled as such by Moses. And he wrote and compiled the first five books, Genesis to Deuteronomy. And this was the commencement of the Bible as a book publicly read and explained. And from that time prophets arose, and generation after generation this was added and that was added. The book of Joshua was added, no doubt by Joshua. He was the main writer of it. Then we have the book of Judges, the last of whom was Samuel. Samuel undoubtedly collected all the records. Gideon, Samson, Jephthah, and all these other great men who rose up after Joshua and filled in the gap until David the king, when there was added the great Book of Praise, largely written by David himself, but not completed probably until the time of Ezra. But the large body of it, at least half, the Book of Psalms, which is the praise of the Church of God from that day to this, was then compiled. And so the worship of God was developed in the world in age after age, age after age, until finally Christ came, and in one generation the whole of the New Testament was written. The book of God was completed. Nothing was to be taken from it, nothing was to be added to it. It is difficult for us to project ourselves back into the patriarchal age. And we ought to be sensible of our own privileges. Great though these men were, our privileges are so much greater than theirs. We're sitting here listening to the word of God being talked about. We trust explained a little too. This is a privilege which in those ancient times was unknown, and which was really never fully developed even until the times of the apostles. As even the Jewish synagogue worship, they had the reading of the law, and there were a certain amount of explanation of the law by good men from time to time, but preaching such as we now know it only came in with the New Testament. It pleases God by the foolishness of preaching to save them that believe. Paul says to me, is this grace given? None less than the least of all saints, that I should preach among the Gentiles the unsearchable riches of Christ. We know from the 52nd chapter of Isaiah, the great prophecy that some of us heard all sung about in the oratorio of the Messiah the other day. The Lord gave the word, great was the company of the preachers. And that other word, how does it go in the 52nd of Isaiah? How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him that bringeth good tidings. That word good tidings means the gospel, that bringeth the gospel. The prince of peace, that bringeth good tidings of good, that publisheth salvation, saith unto Zion, my God reigneth. The public preaching was there prophesied by Isaiah to come in with the revelation of God in Christ Jesus. Great are our privileges. Preaching has overspread the whole world. Light has come to all nations. They who sat in darkness and in the shadow of death, upon them hath the light shined. Wonderful in these days in which we live. We sometimes think times are getting very bad, and so they are. We read some of what our forefathers said about them in former generations. They were talking more or less as we speak today. You can almost find your own words about the present age in the words of our forefathers who wrote their books and preached their sermons regarding the terrible times, but in their day, and how they were expecting the judgment of God, of the day of judgment almost any minute, just as we are. We with more cause, because of course we're that much nearer the end of time. I only mention it to show that no matter how bad things may be, how wonderful it is that the word of God is preached, that this public worship, that there's light and truth abounding on every side. We can get it if we want it. We go back to these patriarchal times, and we find that things were very, very different. No Bible to guide them. The Spirit of God was there, of course. They had their records. They knew all about Adam. They knew all about the flood mentioned in the book of Job. And the subsequent events were only too recent for them to have perished from the memory of mankind. The terrible judgments of God in the days of Noah, and the Tower of Babel, the awful calamity which came upon mankind when man's tongue was cursed, scattered abroad. Time of the confusion of tongues as a judgment from God. All these things were well known, well in mind. There were those still alive upon the earth who remembered these great calamities and events. If the chronologies of what we understand of the chronologies in the book of Genesis, subsequent to the flood, are rightly read by us, then Shem must have been alive still at the time that Jacob fled from his brother Esau into Padan Aram, near where Job had lived. There were memories still, living memories upon the earth of the great events, and it was by this means, by the lengthening of the lives of men, that God perpetuated his knowledge from age to age, even in the absence of books and public worship. The age of man was cut down rapidly after the flood, so that we see that Shem outlived many of his descendants, including Abraham himself. Now, the reason for this was that they were rapidly approaching the time when the Lord was going to introduce something new into the world. And that something new, of course, was his law. New in the sense it was publicly made known for the first time in the form of the Ten Commandments and all the other admonitions which came to mankind through God's servant Moses. There are other reasons why the age of man was cut down. Of course, man couldn't be trusted with long life. And wickedness is severely curtailed by early death, comparatively early death. Now we find that Job, who is a marvellous example of the type of patriarchal religion, the kind of thing which went on amongst godly people in those days, we find him described here as a man perfect and upright, one that feared God and eschewed evil. Now it's very important that we should attend to that, because basic to the understanding of the book of Job is Job's character, which was very, very much impugned by his friends, as you well know, in the course of the dialogues which compose the later part of the book. His friends said that Job's sufferings were so great because obviously he must have been a great sinner. And although they weren't able to pinpoint his sin, they said it must be so because of the extremity of your sufferings. Now right at the very beginning we are assured in the language of inspiration that this was not the case, that Job did not suffer because he was sinful. He suffered for an entirely different reason, which was entirely hid from the minds of his three friends. Basic to the understanding of the book is the fact of Job's piety and his integrity before God. That the righteous do suffer, and sometimes suffer worse than the wicked. And this is unfolded throughout the book. Job's friends, who argued with him, discussed with him, said many things that were true. The only fault that was in them was that the truth which they uttered did not apply to the case in point. They were uttering general truths, but the application of it did not belong to Job. They were arguing a case which did not exist before them. Therefore, their words are valuable. They say many things which are true. Their words in that sense were inspired words. And yet they were not speaking to the point. Yet it was necessary in the providence of God that they should take this attitude to Job, because otherwise the book of Job would never have been written. And as much as we wouldn't have known. It's only because they challenged Job's character that the whole meaning of Job's sufferings came out. And the book was developed along the lines that it has developed and became the greatest book in the Bible for the explanation of the mystery of evil. So you see how the providence of God works. He brings Job into this dreadful situation and exposes him to the criticism of his friends. And this is one of the heaviest crosses he had to bear. They were his friends. They'd often met together to discuss divine things, to talk together. They were wise men. And, true sense, they were God-fearing men. The weaknesses of which are common to mankind. But they were Job's friends, and no doubt they'd often met together in conference to talk about the history of God's dealings with men hitherto and the meaning of things. They knew each other's minds so well. But unless they had taken this attitude to Job, the full meaning of the book could never have come out. The meaning of Job's sufferings, and we would have been deprived of much. You see how the providence of God works to bring much good out of much evil. So the book starts with laying down the fact that Job was a man of deep piety and integrity before God, and that God accepted him as such. He was not a wicked man. He was not suffering for his own wickedness. And elsewhere must lie the meaning of his trial. Now we notice the four principles of his character and wonder to what extent the same might be true of us. He was perfect and upright, feared God, and eschewed evil. These four things. Now, to be perfect in the Bible sense means to be simple-hearted or single-hearted. And in John Wycliffe's translation, in the Old English of the 13th and 14th centuries, Wycliffe, in his translation of the Bible, uses the word here. Instead of perfect, he calls it simple. Now, the word simple has changed its meaning, of course, in the course of the centuries, although we still use it in a proper sense. We talk about a problem being simplified. We don't mean that it's made childish, like the simplicity of a child, as we speak. And yet even the simplicity of a child really indicates that the child is without guile, without subterfuge, without pretense. And that is why childhood is such a wonderful thing, such a beautiful thing. The child has not yet developed the vices which are common to fallen human nature. And it's beautiful simplicity. It doesn't hide anything. It doesn't pretend. There's no pretense about it. What it thinks, it says. What it says, it thinks. And you know the child's mind because of its simplicity. So, this word in its full development, perfect, or simple, as John Wycliffe said, means a heart which is singly devoted to God and to divine things. Not devoted to evil, but wholly disposed to good, devoted to God. It doesn't mean sinless. Job, like everybody else, was the heir to a fallen nature, wonderfully disciplined, it must have been, powers of evil so much limited as they are, if we address ourselves to the management of our lives as we ought, There's much that can be done for the limitation of evil in thought, in words, and action. This is well known. We can discipline ourselves. Despite the fact that we've got a human nature within, about which Paul speaks, "O wretched man that I am," that is wholly devoted to evil, is ever reaching out after evil. Nevertheless, with the exercise of true piety, watching and praying, exercising discipline over our thoughts and words and doings, taking advantage of all the grace of God which is placed within our reach, it is possible to the greatest of limits, the powers of evil within, to express themselves. And the perfect man is a man whose heart is devoted to God. And the more our heart is devoted to God, the more we shall have the advantage over Satan and over the evil which we know lurks constantly in our own heart. Job was perfect and upright. It is thought that this word upright means, as the word perfect has to do with God, so the word upright has to do with man, his fellow man. He was righteous in all his dealings with his fellow man. He did not deviate at all from the standards of rectitude in his public behavior and in all his contacts with his fellow men. He was known to be an upright man. He was not only perfect towards God, that is, simple-minded, devoted to one thing, and that was the glory of God. But he was also upright in his dealings with men. He was exemplary in his public relations. Then we see what the source of his goodness was, how it was that he had this sustained attitude towards God and man. In the two other things which are said to him, he feared God and eschewed evil. Eschewed evil. That is, as we read several times, and indeed once in the book of Job itself, I think twice in the Psalms, repeated elsewhere, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and depart from evil is understanding. Or as the old paraphrase says, wisdom's beginning is God's fear. That is, the fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. It's the fundamental ground of all true religion and all right conduct, that we fear God, that we reverence God. Though there were no Bibles, they had the unwritten record, the history and the memory, repeated from generation to generation amongst godly men, of the story of creation, of Adam, of the fall, of the promise of the seed of the woman which had bruised the serpent's head, of the ultimate overcoming of death and suffering and evil of all kinds, how God was pledged to do this thing. They talked about this. They didn't know as we knew, we now know, how it was all to come about, but they believed just as we believe, with the same faith that we have, and sometimes a very much stronger faith than we've got. And knowing these things and discussing them, the topic of their conversation, they bowed their hearts and minds before God in faith and in patience, in the fear of his greatness, in the reverence for his righteousness and truth. As they read this in his judgments upon the earth, as God was pledged to the upholding of his own nature in righteousness and truth, even though the world should perish. And so they had this healthy and wholesome regard for the name of God. As the thought of God came into their minds, they instinctively bowed before God. They were not proud of themselves. They couldn't be, because they saw the greatness of God and the frailty and the littleness of human nature. And so they sought in all things, did these patriarchs, to know God and to receive from Him the knowledge of His mercy and grace. Without the fear of God, there is no progress made in anybody's religion. And that's what disturbs us sometimes, in the kind of evangelism which goes around in our days, which is very, very exciting, and sometimes very rather emotional, which is often very entertaining. But it does not teach the fear of God. The Bible teaches us that great reverence is due to God in the presence of His saints. For our God is a consuming fire. Let us have grace, says Paul, that we may serve God acceptably with reverence and godly fear. For our God is a consuming fire. This needs to be known and taught wherever the word of God is preached and believed. Wherever the people gather. And young and old need to be constantly reminded of the greatness of God. I had the opportunity of saying in a fraternal of men only yesterday at Bolton Way, all ministers of one sort or another, discussing certain things. I said, the great lack that there is amongst us men in these days is the lack of emphasis or knowledge of the doctrine of God. The doctrine of God. Some of them were candid enough to acknowledge that this was the case. We hear about many things, but there are very few sermons about God, who He is and what He is, the fear of God. Well, he was one that feared God and eschewed evil. That is, he separated himself from it. He had an abhorrence of evil. And he avoided it. He kept himself out of the way of it. He removed himself from ungodly company. He didn't encourage it by his presence. He moved away from it. He eschewed evil. He's very sensitive to the least approach of evil to his soul. He fled from it. These four things. Now it's very, very important that we should know that this was the character of Job. As I have said, because the book depends upon our recognition of this fact. That whatever happened to Job, it was not because he was other than what has herein been described. The cause of his sufferings were not in himself. They were elsewhere. And this is the problem of the book of Job. His friends didn't understand this, not at the time. They did at the end. They saw how wrong they were. But at the time they did not know, and they did not recognize it. They did not penetrate to the meaning of it. They thought that the cause of Job's sufferings must be in himself. But they weren't, because he was what these four things indicate before God. He was a man of piety, true piety and integrity. It is borne out by the fact of his wealth and position. He was a man of very great power. He was the greatest of all the men of the East. All that part of the country, that is. He had a very great household. That means he had innumerable servants. He would need them to look after 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels, and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she asses. With all the agriculture which went with that, the cultivation of the land, looking after vast estates. For you may depend upon it that 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 1,000 oxen and 500 she asses would require a large amount of country for grazing if they were to be kept alive. So he was not nomadic. He had a settled residence. He had to have with that amount of property. And he had to have that innumerable number of servants in order to raise from the ground the sustenance for his camels and oxen and for the carrying on of his trade. He must have been a man of immense wealth. He lived in the track of the world's trade at that time, which flowed up and down the valley of the Euphrates and the Tigris. Where he lived was in the northern regions near the sources of the Euphrates and Tigris rivers. These two rivers which flowed down parallel, a great space in between them, but they met eventually in the Persian Gulf. And the land in between those rivers is still known as Mesopotamia, which is a Greek word, which potamos or something, is river, meso is in the midst. Mesopotamia means the land in between the rivers, that's between the Euphrates and the Tigris. It is the seat of the human race, that's where civilization began. And that is where the human race was centered after the flood. If you take a map, you will see the mountains of Ararat in the north, in the country we now know as Armenia, partly in Russia and partly in Turkey. And you'll notice that from the map that the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers, those great rivers, take their rise in the mountains of Ararat. So that when the ark rested at Ararat, and the waters drained from off the face of the earth, and they began to come down to the lower levels, the human race, multiplying as it drifted along, followed the course of the rivers and filled the country of Mesopotamia. And that was the source of civilization, development of the human race after the flood. And all movement of population, they couldn't go across the wilderness because there wasn't water. They had to follow the line of the river. They had to go by the river valleys, as they do to this day. Because you cannot exist in the wilderness without water. Therefore, all the armies of Alexander the Great, for instance, when he attacked Persia, they had to follow the line of the rivers. To go by the Euphrates and Tigris valleys. The Romans did the same. Now this is interesting and important because Job lay right in the very track of all human affairs. And he must have been a man of great wealth because his property was extensive and the products of his agriculture and of his cattle and camels, things of that nature, so necessary for the welfare of a developing human society, they were available in the very track of the avenues along which trade flowed. He was a great man. He was the greatest of all the men of the East. There were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. Now the important thing about these facts is not merely their interest as throwing light upon the origins of our civilization. But, with all his wealth, and with all his position, importance, his significance as a prince amongst men, it left his character unimpaired. He remained what he was, a godly man. Simple in his attitude to God and in his attitude to his fellow men. A man just and upright in all his dealings. He is one of those giants of men who carry upon their shoulders the moral welfare of the human race. As long as Job was there, the knowledge of God spread abroad. He was in a position that this should be so. So we notice that not only his piety and integrity before God lies at the basis of our understanding of the book, but the practical lesson that all his advantages did not spoil him. His wealth and position left his character unspoiled and unimpaired. The fact that there were 7 sons and 3 daughters, there were 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels, the 7 and the 3, and the equal numbers, the 500 yoke of oxen, that's 1,000. Yoke is 2. And 500 she asses, which were very, very important. The horse was not a beast of burden in those days. The horse was only used in those days for military purposes, for warfare. The horse had never been used up to that time for draft purposes as it came to be in later days. I think that largely arose in Egypt. I think Egypt was the first power which discovered the full use of the horse, especially for military purposes. Now the fact that there are these even numbers, the 7 and the 3, in his family and his flocks and his herds, has been thought by some to be so artificial that obviously Job was not a real character, that 7,000 and 3,000 and all that. Well, it is unnatural, it's artificial, it's obviously simply poetic and dramatic, just giving us a kind of a backcloth to an ancient drama. But we see things differently from that. We see here the completeness of God's providential gifts in the case of Job. God was preparing something. He was showing in those, even in those early days, the significance of the 7 and the 3. And it is carried out in worship here. His sons were in the habit of meeting in one another's houses in turn, beginning at the eldest and going down to the youngest. Whether every week of the year, we do not know. But at any rate, there were seasons when they met together and entertained each other in one another's houses, no doubt not very far from the family seat where Job and his wife remained with their 3 daughters. And they invited the 3 daughters with them. Whenever they met for feasting, the 3 daughters were there. And it was kept up for a whole week, if not a succession of weeks, day by day. And has been pointed out, the fact that they had their sisters with them, there was a guarantee of their good conduct. For if men want to behave in a profligate way, they make sure that their female relatives are not around. But they invited their sisters there, never met without their sisters. And the importance of woman, you see, keeps man afloat very often. Never underestimate the power of a woman. Sorry about that, Mr. Matthews, but mine will be going up in a minute too.